Welcome back, everybody, to Science Decoded, where we take recent scientific discoveries and break them down so that everybody can understand it. After all, typically everyone really does benefit every time we advance knowledge. From technology, to medicine, to space, globally, we unite under this discipline, or this science, so that we can hopefully not only further our knowledge, but further our progress as humanity. I hope everybody had a great summer. I know everybody at my university is coming back. It's so nice to see everybody in person and see the friendly, smiling faces. And it's even nice that the parking lot is full again and full of pedestrians walking around without crosswalks. But no, actually, it's really good. And I hope you guys all had a great summer. I hope you guys are looking forward to the fall of 2021. There's a lot of really exciting things happening, and hopefully we'll be able to finish this year with a bang. Using today's paper as a cornerstone study, we'll be focusing on the study of biosignatures, otherwise known as signs of possible life on other planets. Our scientist, Dr. Svetlana Skolar, has been working to uncover ways in which these biosignatures may be lying to us, such as when we see them on Mars. She does this by investigating certain naturally occurring and logically plausible inorganic compounds, which may mimic the same signal as biosignatures on the instruments that we use in outer space, such as spectroscopy instruments. And this study is important so that if we see signatures like this on Mars, we know if they're from life or just from natural geologic processes. In order to understand more about biosignatures, there's a few questions I feel we need to answer. First, I think it's important to ask, what is a biosignature? A biosignature are just certain chemicals which are only present when biological reactions are happening, and we can detect these using a variety of chemical detection methods. Anytime their presence is detected, it can be used as evidence for potential signs of life, either current or previous. There are many ways to detect these chemical compounds, but spectroscopy is one of the most widely used, and one that most scientists are familiar with. Spectroscopy uses light, most often produced by lasers, to tell us information specifically about the identity of the chemical in the laser's pathway. It's important to note that there are two types of spectroscopies compared in this paper. One measuring how much light is absorbed by a chemical, also called fluorescent spectroscopy, and one measuring how much light bounces off a chemical, or scatters off of it. This is called Raman spectroscopy. If you think about it like a cloud, and you shine a flashlight through a cloud, these two instruments just tell us how much is absorbed by the cloud, how much goes through the cloud, and how much bounces back off the cloud that we can actually see. The information from these lasers and their signals has to do with the interaction between a molecule's energy and the laser's energy. But sometimes, different molecules, as we've stated, can have identical energy signals. Why do these instruments and their functions matter? Well, because those instruments have already been paid for by taxpayer money, and on top of that, they've already been deployed on recent rover missions. NASA has instituted a new type of instrument called SHERLOCK, which stands for Scanning Habitable Environments with Raman and Luminescence for Organics and Chemicals. Luminescence is also another science word for fluorescence. The rover Perseverance also has what's called a SuperCam instrument system on board, and this mission is directly looking for biosignatures through Mars sample return to Earth, meaning potentially this rover will be able to collect samples and send them back to Earth for later analysis to determine if there was life or is currently life present on the planet. It was launched earlier this year in February of 2021. These spectroscopy systems are actively in use for potential biosignature detection on Mars. It's also important that we're assured and instruments accurate when we finally come out with evidence or a claim saying that we have evidence that life was on another planet. It minimizes the chances that we would claim to find life when we actually haven't. And this is where Dr. Skolar's research steps in, to investigate how to distinguish between these false positive signals and the real deal. And you'll hear how she does this when we get back, so stay tuned!
Thank you.
Well, welcome back to Coders. We have another exciting paper today to discuss. I'm here with Dr. Svetlana Scholar. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your job and your primary responsibilities in your field for listeners who might be interested in what you do for a living?
Sure. I am Svetlana Scholar. I am currently a postdoc at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. So I am primarily an astrobiologist. And what that means is I'm interested in the study of course, life elsewhere. And also a lot of astrobiology is the study of Earth and how and why life arose on Earth, and using Earth as basically our practicing field for exploring other planets and environments that are similar to those on other planets. And particularly my research involves using Earth to explore signs of life on Mars and helping Mars astrobiology rovers like the current Perseverance rover look for signs of life. And that is part of the work that I do. Another part of the work I do is through a NASA project at the Center for Life Detection. And we're actually looking to sort of standardize our approaches for looking for life elsewhere. We're working with members of the community to basically develop tools and, you know, things like databases to basically standardize the language we all speak and kind of standardize the language we use to recognize and the criteria we use to recognize life elsewhere. So those are my primary kind of roles. And I'm actually a postdoc, which means I'm sort of at a crossroads in my research. Normally after graduate school, you do this period of postdoctoral training, which is generally, you know, a few years, like something like 2 to 4 years. And I'm sort of at the end of that phase and still sort of transitioning to a more permanent position.
Well, it sounds like a very exciting time. And it sounds like a lot of really interesting research is going on around you. And you're learning a lot from the people and the career path you've decided to pursue. And that kind of brings me to your recent paper. So in your recent paper titled Detecting Cerium 3+ as a Biosignature Mimicker Using UV Time-Resolved Laser-Induced Fluorescence and Raman Spectroscopy, Implications for Planetary Missions. So I think there's a lot of really useful information within that title, and even gives us starting points for our discussion here. So in that paper, what would you say was the research topic your group was specifically investigating, or what was your thesis or your hypothesis?
The goal of this paper was to help the current rover on Mars, Perseverance rover, in its biosignature detection strategy. So its strategy to find ancient signs of life, or what we call in the field biosignatures. And so one of the instruments that it's using are combined spectroscopy instruments, and they have two different spectroscopy capabilities, Raman and fluorescence spectroscopy. And the goal of this paper was to really document a particular compound that we found could look like life, but it's not life. That's why we're calling it a mimicker of life, which is cerium within natural minerals. And we really just wanted to sort of write a cautionary tale to researchers who are using this type of spectroscopy instrumentation on Perseverance or potentially on future missions, which are going to be looking for signs of life, for example, in solid rock samples. That was the sort of environmental context for this type of research. When you're looking for signs of basically fossil carbon in solid rock samples on Mars in this particular case, or in future, you know, it could be applicable to future astrobiology missions on other surfaces as well, you find something that looks like a certain type of carbon rich signal, which on Earth would indicate if that's carbon, that's probably something that is preserved in this rock that came from life, like a previous cellular life form or something like that. And that's not necessarily the case. It just the spectral signal sometimes looks like a carbonaceous signal. And if it's not, we just wanted to write this cautionary tale as one example of, well, it could be cerium instead, and this is what it looks like, and this is how we can tease out that false signal. And so this research is motivated by sort of a larger question to help Perseverance rover identify samples to be cached and later returned to Earth as what we call the Mars Sample Return Campaign. So the Mars Sample Return Campaign, or MSR, is a campaign where the Perseverance rover mission will use its spectroscopy and other payload instruments to select a handful of samples, essentially, that will be placed in a tightly sealed container, kind of like a carousel container. And then later that will be retrieved by another vehicle and returned to Earth. And when those samples come back to Earth, they will be studied for their potential to contain signs of life. So that's why we're calling them potential biosignatures until they're confirmed. And that confirmation will likely occur on Earth, not on Mars. So I just want to be clear about the fact that we're looking for potential biosignatures. If they will ever be confirmed as real signs of life, that will be a very, very challenging undertaking. And if it ever happens, it will be done in the higher resolution, bigger scale analyses on Earth, on using instruments you can't put on a rover remotely. And so, this was part of an effort to document one possible false signature of life and to really tell the community to be careful if we see it on Mars, and to help us make a decision whether or not to cache a potential sample for potential return to Earth.
And how do we know how cerium-3 plus forms naturally, and if it's even common?
That's a good question. In my researching for this, I learned that cerium is actually a lot more common than I realized in natural rocks. Cerium is basically what we call a rare earth element, and it can be substituted for more common elements that are part of natural minerals, particularly calcium, calcium 1 and 2. So in the formation of many natural minerals on Earth, like sulfates, like plagioclase, like clays, which have a lot of calcium in their mineral structure, naturally, sometimes cerium can basically substitute into the calcium holes in that structure. So that's why we get enrichment of really any rare earth element in minerals, and particularly in this case, cerium. So it does happen naturally. It has never been directly measured on the surface of Mars, but we know it is on Mars because we have meteorites that have come to us on Earth from Mars, and we've identified those meteorites chemically as definitely coming from Mars. So we're sure that, first of all, those rocks originated on Mars, and we can measure the abundance of cerium in those. And so basically from the very, very small sample size meteorites that we have on Earth, and some of those coming from Mars, we've basically gotten a range of cerium abundances. So we kind of expect it to occur on Mars within that range, probably.
So your report states that cerium is yet to be discovered on Mars itself, but we do know it's been discovered on Martian meteorites. And therefore, people argue that cerium could show up when performing these experiments on Martian soil, like on Mars. Why is that a valid conclusion? How do we know that those meteorites actually came from Mars?
So cerium actually is very common in a lot of natural minerals on Earth, and we think on Mars as well. On Earth, basically, cerium comes into the mineral as a substitution into its calcium structure. So a lot of natural minerals like clays, like sulfates, like plagioclase, that have a calcium-2 particularly, they can substitute for a cerium-3. And so this happens kind of naturally. And so that's how you get cerium enrichment generally in a natural mineral. And so we know how this happens on Earth. And on Mars, we've seen examples of these minerals. We've seen it basically in the landing site of Perseverance rover, which is called Jezero Crater, which is an ancient lake, a paleo lake. We see the types of mineral lithologies that we know on Earth often substitute calcium for cerium and basically enrich themselves in cerium. And we also know that there's probably cerium on Mars because we see it in meteorites from Mars. We have a lot of meteorites that fall to Earth. We're basically, meteorites basically commonly rain down on Earth. And what we can do is we can analyze the gases and the other chemical aspects of the meteorites, and we can basically come up with a really good idea of where they originated from. And so we have a very small sample size of meteorites on Earth that have come to us from Mars. And we definitely know they're from Mars because we can see, for example, the composition of gases in these little air bubbles in the meteorites. I think that's really cool that we can understand that they're from another planet based on, compositional clues like little air bubbles. We basically, that's how we know that those meteorites came from Mars. And we have measured cerium in a variety of minerals in those Martian meteorites. And so for this work, I actually surveyed the literature on cerium abundances in all of the known Martian meteorites. And there aren't many of them. There's a handful. And I basically came up with a range of about something like 5 parts per million to something like 4,000 parts per million of cerium, of known cerium concentration in all the minerals that we have from Martian meteorites. And so that kind of gave us a large and a small range of cerium abundances to expect on Mars. Now, there's sort of a caveat to this. We have actually never measured cerium definitively on the surface of Mars, let alone with a remote rover. So the information we have about cerium on Mars comes from a meteorite that fell to Earth from a location where it was ejected on Mars. How many, millions of years ago, we don't know. And where was it ejected from? We absolutely don't know. It was probably ejected from a lot deeper than the surface, based on the way impacts and cratering and, impact ejecta happens. We assume it was pretty deep. So the cerium information that we have from Mars is probably not from the same place on Mars where a surface rover will be roving. So we basically, for this research, we basically had to assume that that was the known concentration of cerium. And from there, we created our experiment to sort of mimic those abundances based on what we do know from Martian meteorites. It wasn't a perfect experimental setup, but we did use what we knew about Mars.
When you went about making this Martian soil and doping it with the cerium, did you dope it with less amounts of cerium than what you noticed as well to kind of try and find a detection limit of these instruments to see, it's 50 parts per million of cerium that's detected, but if there's less, you can't see it?
Yeah, that's actually exactly what we did. We went a factor of 10 under that range that I found, and we went about double the amount that I found. So we went both lower and higher than that range to push the limit a little bit higher and lower of cerium concentrations in the samples that we created to see, exactly what you're saying, to see whether there was a certain limit of detection of cerium. That was part of the question that we asked. The first question we asked was whether or not the organic compounds that we were looking at mimicked anything like cerium. We had to start with a large sample suite of different amino acids, hydrocarbons, a variety of organic compounds that are basically basic components of cells, basically a suite of biosignatures that you could detect on Mars spectroscopically. And the first thing we had to do was compare if any of them really looked like cerium. And the first thing we found was that an amino acid called tryptophan actually looks very, very similar to cerium. And then the next phase of the experiments was to see whether the concentration of cerium affected that comparison of higher or lower concentrations of cerium in a simulated Martian analog soil could still mimic tryptophan. And so what we did was we created a soil simulant that is basically based on the composition of a site visited by the Curiosity rover or Mars Science Lab rover. There was a soil simulant created to mineralogically be similar to that site. And so we basically took that soil simulant and we doped it with different concentrations of cerium to see if there was a detection limit. And basically we found that in all of the concentrations that we looked at, you definitely see that cerium signal in the same place. That cerium signal doesn't really change. Of course, its intensity changes depending on the intensity, depending on the concentration of cerium. And that's what we expected to see. But there weren't any peak shifts. There weren't any shifts of energy in that spectrum, which basically led us to conclude that it doesn't really matter how much cerium you have. If there is even a really small amount of cerium in these minerals and no life or no organic compounds or amino acids that could be a biosignature, you're going to see that cerium, and that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, for sure. And did you guys try an experimental condition where you added both cerium and tryptophan to the Martian soil?
Yeah, we did. And we basically the problem is with the technique, the first technique we used is fluorescence spectroscopy, is that you get basically a very convoluted mixed signal. Spectroscopy relies on the fact that every component in your sample produces a very clean, discrete, narrow band. That band has a particular, you know, peak, it has a particular width. And so you can, you know, use quantitative measurements about that band to identify the compound. However, the more things you mix together, the more peaks you get and the more complex those peaks are. And when those peaks are too close together, they basically just sum to a larger, narrower peak. And you can't necessarily deconvolve each of those components. The conclusion we came to was that it was pretty difficult to deconvolve and to unmix and to reliably identify those components when we mixed different organics and we mixed the cerium. And I think, again, this really adds to the cautionary tale on Perseverance rover. I mentioned two different spectroscopy techniques on two different instruments, fluorescence and Raman spectroscopy. I've only been talking about fluorescence spectroscopy so far. That was sort of the central experimental technique we used in this paper. But let's not forget that the two techniques are supposed to be working hand in hand complementarily. Some work I did previously has actually illustrated that it's the combination of the two spectral techniques that can really help increase your confidence in potential biosignature identification. And so in this work, we said, okay, well, when the fluorescence spectroscopy is difficult to interpret, could we go to the Raman spectroscopy? Could the Raman give us additional compositional information based on those spectra alone on the exact same samples and on the exact same, you know, locations on the samples? And what we found was in this particular case, the answer was no, because the particular excitation wavelength of the Raman laser causes a lot of absorption. And so what we saw was basically that it was funny enough that the cerium in the samples was absorbing the entire signal. And so we were not able to see really any other compositional information on these samples because of that laser's excitation wavelength. So Raman was actually not able to give us better compositional information. That was yet another conclusion to add to this sort of cautionary tale in this paper that we should be very careful when interpreting signals from these instruments that may seem organic.
So because Perseverance has a fluorescence and a Raman spectroscopy instrument, each individual, that are designed to basically do what the other can't, you guys decided to look at what the Raman would do, what kind of pictures the Raman would take of this soil. Was the picture distinguishable or indistinguishable from the organic picture? Can you elaborate more on your Raman results?
Yeah, so the Raman results were also challenging to interpret in a very different way than the fluorescence results. Fluorescence is far more sensitive than Raman in identifying things like low levels of organics in a mineral matrix, or when you're looking at a rock on Mars. Another way of putting it is preserved carbon in that rock at a very, very, very small concentration from something that was like maybe if there was ever some sort of like cellular, unicellular organism, if they were preserved in that rock, the carbonaceous compounds from it at a very low level of abundance, they could be potentially identified using fluorescence spectroscopy. And that's sort of the strength of that technique. And the strength of the Raman technique is that it is far better at identifying the components more quantitatively, I should say, because the spectral information that you get from Raman is usually far more discrete. If a compound is identified with Raman spectroscopy, there aren't many other compounds that would overlap with that spectrally and share the same spectral bands. Often a compound in Raman spectroscopy has many Raman bands, and you often rely on both the most intense, the primary, and then the other ones, the secondary bands. And you sort of, you know, put all those together and identify all of them together and then assess, you know, and identify what you probably have. So Raman is better in terms of identifying things in that way, but it's less of a sensitive technique than fluorescence. And both techniques are also, the advantage of using both techniques is that you don't necessarily have to change your sample or powder it or put it through any sort of complex equipment inside the rover's body, which is untrue for certain other organic identifying techniques. So the Curiosity rover did have an organic identification instrument that required both powdering and complex engineering to identify anything organic, anything that would be potentially a biosignature. And so the advantage of both fluorescence and Raman spectroscopy is that you don't destroy the sample in any way. You have that rock intact, and then you can bring it, because remember, the point of identifying potential biosignatures with Perseverance is to then bring them back to Earth to return them through the Mars sample return campaign. And if those samples are intact when they arrive on Earth, that will make it a lot better for astrobiologists to be able to identify any biosignatures within them, because we would be able to see the environmental context of that sample, which is very, very important to us.
Do you think that this sort of cerium spectrum comparison to organic compounds holds for other important organic molecules or biomolecules that we know of, such as DNA or lipids? Do you think that a spectrum of DNA or lipids in Martian soil would give the same signal as the cerium 3+ in the Martian soil?
That's an interesting question. So every individual organic molecule, like every particular amino acid that we tested, each has a fluorescence peak and also Raman spectral information that is different. So you would be able to identify any of them if they were, of course, pure and individually, you know, present individually. But what is the likelihood that on Mars we're going to find, you know, tryptophan floating around in very clean water? It's pretty low, because that tryptophan, if it is on Mars, it's going to be very, very complex. It's going to be degraded. It's going to be mixed with other biomolecules. And most likely what it will be is going to be just a big blob of what we call macromolecular carbon, or MMC. In the Earth's record of fossils and fossil degradation, what we know is that carbon doesn't like to stay in its original form, like in the form of the original biomolecule. What it likes to do is it likes to become more thermodynamically stable with all the changes that happen when it gets buried under rock. And so whatever you started with, whether it was a lipid or an amino acid, the longer it's in the terrestrial record or the Martian rock record, the longer it is buried and compacted and undergoing environmental changes through time, the more degraded it's going to become, and the harder it's going to be to interpret its fluorescence or Raman spectral signal. I don't think we really are expecting to find DNA or a lipid or a pure amino acid in their individual forms on Mars. What we are really going to find is going to be this macromolecular carbon, this chunky blobs of stuff that has been compacted and squished, essentially, and has become a little bit more thermodynamically stable. And to give you an idea of what that looks like, it basically, carbon wants to turn into graphite. Graphite is these very nice sheets of six-ringed carbons, which are called polyaromatic hydrocarbons. So these six-ringed carbons, they just want to stack themselves into these nice planar sheets. That is the structure of ideal graphite. But of course, nature is not ideal. So you're going to have some degraded carbon and some that still resembles the biomolecule and some that's something in between. So all of that is to say that carbon gets very degraded and very messy in the rock record as it gets older and as it undergoes environmental changes in the rock record. And so what we are going to find most likely, and what we have found with the previous Mars rover, with the Curiosity rover, is evidence of this type of carbon, this macromolecular clumps of lots of things that we can't really disentangle into their organic components. But the biggest question that remains is, did this carbon come from life on Mars, or did it come from a non-life process? Once again, a mimicking process. When I say mimicking, I don't just mean cerium that looks like it's a biosignature. I mean, it could still be carbon, but not be life. That's another type of mimicking process that we're trying to be careful about on Mars. And when the Curiosity rover found this type of macromolecular carbon, the team was not able to conclude whether it was carbon from life or abiotic, non-biological carbon. And that is still a huge, huge mystery because we really will want those samples on Earth to be able to use the incredible expertise and infrastructure and laboratories that we have on Earth that we can't really put on rover to investigate that carbon much, much, much more carefully to be able to really say anything, if anything conclusive about that carbon. So that just gives you yet another catch 22 about how difficult it really is to find biosignatures on Mars.
Yeah. And, you know, given all that you just said, how do you hope other scientists use this information you talked about in your paper to make decisions and draw conclusions when investigating life on other planets in the future?
The cerium example was intended to be sort of a cautionary tale. We just wanted to document that, hey, this is one potential process that looks like life, but be careful because it's not life. I hope that this work kind of fits into a bigger body of literature that will go into maybe a database or some repository where people can say, these are all the potential false signatures of life that we might encounter with the different types of instruments, because it has far more capabilities than just spectroscopy. I've only been describing the spectroscopy capabilities, but it has a huge payload suite of other elemental and imager technologies that can give us a whole host of data sets about a particular sample that can go sort of hand in hand. And each of those is one of the many pieces of the puzzle of whether or not a certain rock has a potential biosignature in it. So I hope this kind of fits into that bigger picture of strategies to inform the search for life on Perseverance rover, and also even on other rovers that, or other planetary surface missions, like, for example, icy bodies that may one day have a surface mission that will do biosignature studies using spectroscopy instruments. So this isn't just work that would inform Mars research. I hope that this would inform any type of astrobiology surface mission research. And so the other aspect that I hope that this work informs is the Mars sample return campaign. When we are, you know, strapped for time and strapped for, you know, the rover rover runs on very limited chunks of time and chunks of energy, and, you know, its resources are not infinite. So when the rover team is basically making decisions very, very quickly, this type of work really helps the Mars scientists identify, okay, we have this type of sample, we have to make this decision. Are we going to cache it or are we not going to cache it based on what we know and based on the Mars analog research that's been done on Earth to help us?
Well, thank you again for coming on and giving us all this information. But before we head out, I do have one more question for you. Is there anything else that you want to tell our listeners? Maybe the reason why you came on the podcast today?
Yeah, I will just add some final thoughts that I think we're in a very interesting time with the Mars exploration program. And Perseverance rover it follows a long history and a long line of previous Mars rovers that have done great work. And we're sort of standing on the shoulders of giants with some of those previous missions. And it's going to be very exciting to see what the sample caching decisions are and which samples end up being delivered to Earth when that happens. So far, it seems that it's probably going to happen in the next decade. So we're crossing our fingers to get some of those samples back on Earth and see what they contain, whether they do contain any exciting signs of life. So I'm just very excited to be part of this endeavor and hopefully participate in the return studies of those samples.
Absolutely. Well, we'll keep our eyes and ears peeled for the return cache samples, and we look forward to hearing more about this endeavor and everything that you guys are doing. Again, thank you for your time, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Justin.
Hi, Gina here. Thanks for listening to Science Decoded. We want to thank our host with the most, Justin Dingman, as well as our behind-the-scenes team members, Osama Alien and Garrett Campion. Our channel artwork was designed by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was written and recorded by Graham Albright. We'd also like to thank our Patreon and local supporters. Without all of you, we couldn't do what we do. SciWorthy is an initiative of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more at www.bluemarblespace.org.